listening to a Right on Radio podcast exclusive with Annie Harview. Let's dig in. You are listening to KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie Harview, and today I'm here talking to Mari Naomi. They are the author of Dragon's Breath and Other True Stories, along with many other collections, prolific comics artist for decades, and I am so excited to have them on the show today. Hi, Mari.
Hi. Thank you so much, Annie, for having me here.
Could you kind of just start us off and welcome those who have not read the collection yet in by kind of briefly just describing the collection, what it's about?
Sure. Dragon's Breath and Other True Stories, which came out a number of years ago. It's all autobiographical stories. The theme centrally is compassion. Most of what I write about involves looking through other people's eyes or, you know, getting into their skin, which I feel like is the whole point of human existence, honestly, and certainly the whole point of literature. So I just was trying to follow along that vein. It's a bunch of short stories. They all hopefully stand on their own, but also kind of interconnect because they are all just my life.
Yeah. And this is a compilation, and part of the joy of a compilation is that there's some work that's older or previously serialized, and there's some newer work, and they're all kind of hanging out together, and a reader can really watch your style evolve over time and see those changes. Do you feel like your evolution over time in your comics stylistically has been deliberate, or like how much do you think the growth and change just is what comes with practice and time?
Well, some of it does. With this particular collection, it's not over a very long amount of time. This was the second book that I came out with. My first book, I was very desperate to promote it. And so after it came out with HarperCollins, you know, Harper Perennial, which is a pretty big publisher, but I was probably the smallest minnow in that big sea. So I was thinking, you know, how do I get my name out there? How do I get this book to sell? So I was just taking a bunch of webcomic jobs and just as any gig that I could take that had high profile so that I could get my name out there and get people interested in my book. And that's what you end up with Dragon's Breath and Other True Stories is a compilation of all I was doing in about a year or two. So it's very short. The reason that you see a lot of change in styles is because I was using that, the webcomic format, which to me seemed like, oh, it's no big deal. No one's going to pay attention to this later. I could just try whatever and be experimental.
Yeah.
Ha ha, joke's on me. It's in a book now that people still read many years later.
Yeah. When you
there
were
one story that involved a leather jacket that I was like, well, I'm just going to try out this new pen set and see if it works. And so that's how I drew that particular comic, was through markers. And I don't think I ever used those markers again, because honestly, I did not enjoy the experience of drawing with them, but it was very experimental for me.
I like the idea of experimenting and then allowing that to be work you shop out and show places, because I feel like a lot of people, including sometimes myself, really get afraid to like show people experiments or show people things you haven't done a thousand times. How did it feel to send out more experimental material? Like, did that just feel run of the mill for you, or was that something you had to make a really conscious choice to hunker down and do?
Well, this is the first time I ever put stuff on the internet, and I was, and I'd been making comics. So this was probably done in 2011 and 12 when I started these stories, and I'd been making comics since the 90s, and it was always in mini comic format or a book or anthologies. So it's a very different experience putting something into the world that, you know, that will end up in random people's hands, you know, maybe a year later, versus putting it on the internet and getting instant feedback. And I it was terrifying and appalling and wonderful and just a beautiful experience, instantly connecting with people, particularly on the Rumpus, where yeah. you know, there was such a tight community of writers there, and everyone was pretty much a compassionate person who would comment. And it was not the same as some other websites that I will not name here, where you do not want to read the comics. With the Rumpus, I very much wanted to read the comics because people were so supportive and wonderful. And it just, mm-hmm. it felt like I was just diving into a community when I was making a lot of these comics. And sometimes I would gauge the comments, and that would determine what I would work on the next week or two. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the progression, the emotional progression of the stories is what really resonated with people. And I would, you know, say, oh, this really resonates, which, you know, of course gives me endorphins when I connect with people. I'm like, this is great. Yeah. And so that encouraged me to make more intimate work down the line, or to do this or that. And I just, you know, I wanted to jump further and further into the pond. It was really great.
That's so cool. Do you feel, having started more in mini comics and paper comics and stuff, do you feel like there were similar learning analogs of that, like from when you were doing like paper work? Or do you think the immediacy of the online comics really just gave a different experience fully about like how instantaneous feedback can be?
It was pretty different. I don't know that I learned anything while I was making mini comics other than to not show certain people your mini comics. but yeah, I feel like I learned so much while I was making these particular comics, you know, both in technique and storytelling and all sorts of things, even though I'd, you know, been making comics for a very long time, but I was very, very alone when I was making those other comics, you know, aside from when I would show it to a friend or a coworker, never again, or you know, whatnot.
Words to live by. What you learn from mini comics is who not to show your mini comics.
Seriously.
So when bringing these web comics, where you were kind of on this like evolutionary snaky journey of learning and feedback, and turning them into a physical compilation, how did you build kind of a structure for the book? Is it a chronological? Is it an ideological structure?
It was chronological for the most part. I was having issues about what to end with, because some of that stuff, like I didn't want to end on a dark note, which I ended up doing because I think it makes for a better book, but you know, but ending on a lighter note wouldn't have been chronological. I mean, ultimately what you see is just the chronology of me. So.
Yeah. Cool. So in a lot of your illustrations, something that I loved visually is every page has this very clean feeling. For those who have looked at the book, you'll see that a lot of the pages give you, some have more traditional little panels and a gutter, but a lot of them are just a single panel on a page. And a lot of the illustrations omit extra details down to exactly what is needed for an image to come across. So like there'll be two people in a car and the car will just be represented by a couple carefully angled lines, but you can still feel the fact that they're in a car and you're not kind of looking at it and thinking like, oh, that kind of looks like a Corolla, or like, oh, I wonder what year it is based on what this car looks like. It just puts you right where you need to be. And I was just wondering for you, what is your process for building a panel and finding exactly the right amount to show versus omit?
While I was making this book, I was sort of learning that technique. Now I'm sort of intuitive about it, thank goodness, yeah. because it would take a long time for me to figure these things out. Mm-hmm. I once had a friend, Rick Caraschio, who's a cartoonist, who suggested that I try telling as much as possible with the fewest lines possible. Mm-hmm. And that's not always my rule, but sometimes it is. And in these instances, it is. I feel like when you do that, you're really zooming in on a feeling or a character. And I really like that, that feeling. Yeah. A lot of when I was making this particular book involved me drawing out entire scenes and then just erasing everything until I had what I wanted. And it was, as you can imagine, took a long time.
I was wondering if you would ever do that, like draw something big and then erase or omit down that.
Yeah.
Did that ever feel painful to like put a lot of labor into something and then get rid of the
Yes. Wow. Talk about killing your darlings. It was pretty rough, especially when I'm particularly happy with how a building came out or something, but sometimes it's just not necessary. And I just, because I was doing all these mini or all these web comics at the same time, also, yeah. I suddenly had deadlines, whereas I really hadn't prior to that, because I was just doing it for my own hobby, just happiness. Yeah. So at one point, the Rumpus asked me to do more, and I think it was every week or every couple of weeks. And all I was doing was making comics all the time. Like, I didn't have time for my freelance work or anything, and I was making these comics that were essentially free. I wasn't making any money off of them for the most part. Wow. And so I was just and I just was working constantly. And so just by that very nature, I got really good at paring down without overtime, without drawing too much. And ultimately, I think I told the Rumpus after a couple of months of this, I'm like, I can't keep up this rate, because I have, you know, all these other webcomics that I'm also working on. It was too much. And so I scaled back a little, but even so, like, I was still working constantly.
Yeah.
I'm now at the point in my life where I'm like, I need weekends. I need a day off sometimes. And I refuse to work on Saturdays and Sundays unless there's something urgent.
Nice. But when you're resting, do you also end up doing art in that time, or has art kind of been cordoned? Do you have I guess what I'm asking is, do you have rest art, or is art primarily in the workspace for you now?
I forbid myself to make art when I'm not on it's not a work day. And, you know, sometimes on work days, because I do have a flexible schedule sometimes, like if I'm not on a deadline, like I will get creative and I will do me stuff on a work day. Mm-hmm. But yeah, weekends are banned. that's the day I clean my house and go do stuff. Otherwise I go crazy. I burn out. Even, you know, you can burn out on fun. It's true.
Definitely. Definitely.
I have a Patreon that I do a lot of my experimenting on now, because I do a daily comic, a diary comic every day for my patrons. Mm-hmm. And that's really where I'm doing most of my art for fun kind of stuff, even though technically it's for money, but really I'm just experimenting, and you know, that's the venue for it. Meanwhile, I have these other graphic novels, et cetera, that I'm just, you know, and freelance gigs that I'm working hard at, and
yeah,
in their structure. I go kind of crazy on Patreon, which is fun.
If someone wanted to look up your Patreon after hearing this interview, what is it?
It's just patreon.com and then my name / Mari Naomi.
Great. Thank you.
They could go on my website and get links to all these things and see lots of free comics there too, if they want.
Sweet. So to kind of dive back into the comics and kind of that very pared down, very present style, something that really drew me to these comics and made me want to talk to you is how good the balance between surprise or pain that immediately follows something big happening in your life or something happening near you, and then the realization that comes a while later, like when there's been space for retrospection and distance and you can really process something that's happened. Is there any kind of necessary cooling period after an event that is true happens in your life and it's a little painful or uncomfortable that you need before you can draw about it? Or like, is there any other sort of healing, or does art kind of fill in a healing role?
I don't really think that art heals, especially old wounds. I think it's actually the opposite, especially with painful memoir. A lot of things you can get over, and then you're like, oh, maybe I can write about them now because it's not so painful. But really, essentially, you're re-wounding yourself by putting yourself back there, because you have to, you're dredging up the memories and you are essentially reliving them for the, I don't know, 40 to 1,000 hours that you're sitting there drawing these things.
Yeah.
So you're just really sitting with them. I recently started therapy, and I'm wondering how that's going to change how my comics appear, because a lot of the challenge for me in comics is to find like take a memoir, a story from my life, and then figure out what the story is, you know, the beginning, yeah, middle, and end. And my therapist kind of does that for me when I'm just like, blah, 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 blah. And she's like, well, what you're saying is, and then she gives me like,
yeah,
a mission statement for my life, which is amazing.
Yeah.
I generally think that you shouldn't, well, you should write whenever you want to write, and you should, you know, draw and, you know, make art whenever you want to make it. Mm-hmm. But what you're going to end up with is going to be vastly different if you've had the more time you've had to sit on it. And I do believe that most things age like wine. Actually, not all wine is like that, but it get better with time because you do have the perspective. But there is something wonderful about reading someone's diary comics or just someone's angry scree that they just, you know, they just figured out. And I feel like sometimes an author not having perspective is just as exciting as them having perspective, because you can feel just like the core, you know, rage or sadness or happiness or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you as the reader might actually have perspective on them and say, okay, you know, you're 25, this is going to pass, or, yeah, or this happened to me, or, oh, I can see, you know, this dark path you're going down, or whatever, or, yeah, you know, that person's no good for you. Mm-hmm. All sorts of things. Like, I think there's value in every kind of art. And generally for me, especially stories like the ones that you see in Dragon's Breath are things that I've had time to think about. Maybe not the ones towards the end of the book, but a lot of, you know, where I was able to draw out the bigger story versus having it be a story of this happened, this happened, this happened. And maybe some of those facts aren't really relevant to the story, but I don't know that yet because I don't have the perspective and see how, you know, how it all ties together, or yeah, my brain, you know, makes that happen over time. And yeah, so it totally depends. My general rule is I like to have time away from it. And when I have mentees, I generally say, well, you know, look, you don't have to rush into this because it's, the story is going to be there as long as you're there. And it will get better with age. You'll have more perspective and you'll see the story better, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't write about it. You should definitely write about everything and then come back to it later when you're ready to write a bigger story, perhaps, if that's what you want to do. Mm-hmm. Although I recently wrote a book, it's not published yet, where it's very immediate and it's almost like reading a diary. And because I wanted to see what that was like. And I think it turned out really well, specifically because it was going against all of my rules that I'd been practicing for years and years and years. So I broke my own rules, and, you know, which was kind of thrilling for me, but it makes for a different kind of story. I don't think there's any right or wrong way, but they do come out with different results.
Yeah.
Long-winded.
Oh no, that was great. I loved it. This is kind of an aside, but while you were talking about like therapy and the role of like art in thinking about something, I guess I could say, I was thinking it might be a fun concept for like a comic or a zine or something to do initially draw or write what the individual, like I or you, for example, think about an event or a series of events and the significance you put in it and the ways it connects to other things, and then draw it again after you've had a therapy session about it to see like how the reframing of an external person and how whatever you're doing, like CBT, DBT, whatever, affects how you conceptualize the event.
That is actually what people do generally with writers groups. And I've kind of done that without a therapist before. Yeah. There's a story specifically in Dragon's Breath about Herb who passed away, killed himself. And I had been trying to write that story for over a decade. And I just recently found the story that I wrote, like, pretty much the night I came home from the bar when I found out he was dead. Yeah. And it's intense, but I kept trying to rewrite that essay and it just wasn't pulling together. And then there was a moment where I'm like, well, what if I make it a comic? And it just pulled together. And I think it's one of my favorite comics that I've made, just because I was finally able to articulate something that I've been trying to for so long. But even before I'd been making comics, I'd been writing about that incident again and again and again, trying to work it out in my head.
Yeah. I think that is definitely an example of something in this collection that stuck with me for days and days after I read it, just thinking about it, because it so encapsulates the feeling of something that you can't really turn into a tidy narrative after it happens. It's something where you don't really expect it and you're not really thinking about ways a certain thing connects, and then just kind of mulling over the circumstances. And I just think that that this book handles that so well. Like, there's such a temptation I love it, because there's such a temptation when making stories about one's life or about how the world works, when trying to turn things into stories to understand them, to make the stories overly pat or like draw too many connections where there aren't any. And there are some places in the collection where you do draw really fun connections that I would not have expected, like the bug infestation that lasts longer than the relationship, for example. Like, there are sometimes really funny parallels and coincidences, but I feel like there's something nice and kind of like anti-think piece about like just writing about the complexity of an experience and kind of the mystery of life in a way, even in the form of mini comics. I think it's actually a great form for that.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
I'm blushing. I don't know, the ring light might be washing me out, but I assure you I'm blushing.
Blushing in podcast. So to keep kind of talking about the meat of the stories and how they work kind of intellectually and emotionally, you're very frank in these comics about how the idealized conception of oneself, or specifically in these comics, yourself, often doesn't match up to what you do in real life or your first instinct. And this is shown from like interactions with vulnerable former friends. This is shown in voting. This is shown in a comic where you're next to a sick stranger on public transit. And it, I was just wondering, how does it feel to share these comics publicly, and like what makes you feel driven to? And I'm especially interested in this in the context of talking a few minutes ago about how it's like, it's not necessarily a healing process. Like, even if it's processing, it's not necessarily a healing process per se.
Well, I think just by nature, I tend to be a TMI person. And the reason that I am like that is because I just really enjoy connecting with people. And I feel like, and this is not always the case, sometimes people don't like TMI, but I feel like to get people out of their shell, that tends to be, you know, when you give a little of yourself, then people give a little of themselves usually. And, you know, in high school, when I figured this out, I would, you know, try to be funny and try to be just self-defacing or self-deprecating. Sorry.
Yeah, no, you're good.
you know, so I've always kind of used that tactic to try to, it's like the big dogs who get down to the little dogs' level to try to be like, not that I'm the big dog, but like, I just don't want to seem like a jerk. I want to make people feel comfortable, because that makes me feel comfortable when they're comfortable, and then everyone wins, and then we could all be friends, and I could find out all their secrets and I could tell them all mine. I mean, I just love that. You know, I love reading people's intimate thoughts. I love hearing people's secrets. I love telling mine. Like, that's just who I am. And I've always been that way. I feel like that's such the magic of just interpersonal relationships, is just, you know, sharing and opening up. So, I mean, that's really what's underlying. When I wrote my first book, Kiss and Tell, which is all pretty much all embarrassing stories about my love life from a young age until my 20s, I thought I was being really open and vulnerable and whatnot. I was just giving all these secrets, blah, here's some really weird stuff that I did. And I think I just got a little, I don't know, fool of myself is the right word, but I was like, oh, look how open I am. And everyone's like, oh, I don't know how you tell these stories, they're so embarrassing. I'm like, yay, I'm so open. And then I read Cheryl Strayed's Dear Sugar column on the Rumpus.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh no, that's what intimacy is. Not the stupid, like trying to make people laugh at my bad mistakes. Like, that's not intimacy. That's just trying to get to people to like you. I'm like, no, I don't want to be that. I want to be open. I want, you know, I just want everything. Mm-hmm. So this collection specifically was inspired by her. At the time she was anonymous, but by her stories, because that's like, that's what I wanted to be. And I thought I was that until I read that and I realized, no, I've got a long way to go. So
yeah.
I feel like each story that I wrote, mostly on the Rumpus, but elsewhere too. And even now, like I was just trying to push myself further and further, like how far can I go with this? Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes it was scary. Sometimes I was admitting things that I'm like, oh, people are going to hate me. Like after I publish this, they're going to hate me. They're going to think, oh God, you were that person that was fighting above me in that apartment, you know, you're one of those. And I'm like, oh God, yeah. Well now this big audience I've built up, they're all going to turn against me. But every time I would open up like that, like I would just feel so much love back from the community. And it just made me realize, okay, I can be myself without, you know, having to worry about people hating me. I mean,
yeah.
And that, I mean, it's a great feeling. And I know that it's not always the case. People get canceled all the time on the internet. And that could certainly happen to me, especially with my habit of putting my foot in my mouth sometimes. But I'm willing to take that risk.
Yeah. I think that what you were saying just now really made me think about the difference between like honest humor and self-disclosure, and then where self-deprecating stuff fits within that. Like, I feel like many of us as young people really lean on self-deprecating or like self-judging in that specific way, kind of making little jabs at one's appearance or one's creative work or something like that. And something
it's
I really-
disarming.
Yeah, it's definitely disarming. It can make you feel a little more comfortable to other people, like they don't think you're arrogant or whatever. But this book to me felt very rooted in self-examination that was not really like negging kind of deprecation. It was very like actually thinking about how do I perceive myself versus how do I actually act, and kind of like exploring kind of a difference that's less of a small surface level deprecation pick and more like examining a question that I'm sure a lot of people have, like how does my self-perception interact with my behavior? And how does it not interact? And that's something I'm assuming, because this probably isn't true for everyone, but at least for me, I found these really disarmingly wonderful, because it was like, I think that's a really valuable kind of work. I think especially right now, there's so much fear about, or generally in a creative life, about doing or saying the wrong thing by accident or admitting mistakes you've made and haven't fully learned the right solution to yet. But there's something so comforting about seeing someone you admire, or even just someone with a bit more of a public platform, making mistakes, admitting them, learning from them, treating life as something to have with a growth mentality. And so, yeah, I just wanted to point that out, because I think the gap between deprecation and analysis is definitely bridged in this work.
I mean, as a Gen Xer, I was raised to be a self-negging person. I mean, that's just like the culture. That's, you know, that's how we show love for ourselves and others. And it's something that I think it's very tired, and I'm tired of it in myself. It still pops up every once in a while, and I'm trying to outgrow that, because I'm over it.
Yeah. Have you ever found self-deprecation to be inhibiting to your ability to create or have certain conversations? Because it seems like you have a strong creative drive, regardless of that, at least based on your proliferation. Prolificness. I'm doing my best.
It hinders me from promoting, or it hinders me from, you know, getting my stuff out there. I mean, I'll put it out there, but like a lot of people have this same issue where they're like, am I talking about my work too much? Am I talking about myself too much? And, I'm over that.
Yeah.
But it took a while. It took a while, because, you know, now I'm like, well, this is my job. Before, I had day jobs and it wasn't my job. This was my hobby. And I'm like, oh God, I have to constantly talk about this show I'm having, or this book, or this comic. And it felt horrible. And what's worse is even finding out that people, they thought it was horrible too. But, you know, sometimes you have to do that when you're starting out, but what are you going to do? It's part of It's part of the gig. And I think more people realize that. And if they don't, then they can, you know, go do their own thing.
Yeah.
I'm definitely learning as I edge closer to age 50, just to not care what other people think. So that's nice.
Yeah. I also think, as you say that about, I listen to a lot of podcasts and interviews with Nicole Georges, and
oh, I love her.
Yeah. She's cool. And, there are a lot of instances where she is answering advice on her podcast, and a lot of people are very afraid to self-promote. And she talks about, like, A, it is your job, but also B, like, the people who want you to follow through and the people who are interested in seeing what you're doing really value seeing that. And how, when she thinks about someone she cares about, she would want to see them promote their stuff. She would want to see what they're working on. And I try to think about that. I did not phrase that quite nearly as well as she did, but like the, just thinking about that as a two-sided coin, like there is the kind of glut of content on the internet where you'll stumble across someone whose stuff isn't exactly your taste. And that would perhaps need to lead to like negative interactions. But the idea,
I mean, there is,
yeah,
there's definitely a balance. There are people who are told by other people, perhaps their publisher, perhaps people they want to be their publisher, that you need a social media presence, and they don't know how to go about that. And then they get online and they're like, oh, okay, so I'm gonna get a Twitter, and then I'm just gonna promote, and that's all I'm gonna do.
Yeah.
And yeah, no one wants that. No one wants to follow that. You know, it's like going to a party and someone's like, my book. And yeah, you want to hear about their book once you like them. But
yeah.
So there's definitely a balance, and I think it's important to, you know, to spread the gospel of like, look, you know, you're at a party, talk to other people, interact with other people, don't send them private messages. Oh, you know, follow me for da 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 da, or don't ask people to follow you, like make them interested in you. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, once they're interested, then throw out like, oh, by the way, here's what I'm doing, because they're already interested. But you know, when you just go there, it's just like a jackhammer of self-promotion for some people, but that's just because they don't know how to use the platform. They're not bad people. You know, that's just what they do. It takes a lot of getting used to figuring out how to use the different social media platforms. And there's always a new one, and, you know, hopefully there'll be even more new ones. But there's, you know, there's definitely, you know, sometimes I remember in my 20s, there'd always be like the 25-year-old guy who was just like promoting his party. And all he would talk about is like promoting his party. I'm like, who are you under there? Like,
yeah.
So there's a balance.
Yeah. Yeah. On the topic of kind of connecting online and networking with other people's creations and such, for anyone who doesn't know, Mari has created databases and resources that can help you find underrepresented or marginalized creators. Like, there's a queer comics database, there's a people of color comics database. And I just wanted to ask you, Mari, how do those resources intertwine with your own creative work beyond just pertaining to your own identities?
So I have the Cartoonists of Color, the Queer Cartoonists, and the Disabled Cartoonists. I'm not at this time a disabled cartoonist, but I thought that's something that I wanted to add to the databases because I feel like there should be one. I am queer and I'm a cartoonist of color, but I feel like I'm at the point of my career where I don't really need the help that I'm giving others through the databases. Like, I'm in the databases, two of them, but they're not really for me. I feel like they're kind of my community service.
Yeah.
A little bit. Like, I think of all the things that I would have, you know, I mean, in the 90s, it really sucked to be a not white male person who makes comics. And I felt like there was a lot of gatekeeping, whether real or perceived, but either way, it still stopped people who were not in that group.
Yeah.
And, I don't know. I saw an opportunity to help others and I just, you know, why not?
Yeah. So. Yeah. That's really neat. And especially since anytime, at least it appears as such. It feels like anytime an industry starts to open up outside white men, just there's this whole slew of promotion of white women. And it's like, just, it's nice to see the variety thrown in and to see the interactions with specific identities and acknowledging kind of the intersections available therein. Just because it can be so easy to just promote people who already have a lot of the resources that white men have, and just to see, the variety available in those is really great.
Not that I have a problem with white men. I have some white male friends. They're wonderful.
Yeah. No, it's about sharing. It's about letting people do what they want to do.
That's true. I mean, just even as a reader, this is my selfish side. I want to see more diverse stories because, as I said, connecting and learning about new things is one of the great things about reading. And just to see these same old, I'm not going to describe a story, but there's a lot of the same story out there, especially in comics where it's maybe not. There's a lot of the same story out there. So I want to see more. And I love personal autobio, especially stories, but I like all the stories and I want to see more. And this is my way of making it happen. I mean, I feel like I'm in a really privileged situation where, I have a little bit of power. So I'm like, okay, well, how can I distribute this so that other people can have this power too? Like, it feels great. Because what else is the point really? Having power.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great.
Unless I wanted to ruin, wreck the environment. That's another thing I could do with my power. Just kidding.
I think plenty of people already love doing that with their power. So right.
I won't bring up NFTs right now. JK, LOL.
I just, what the world needs is just another podcast talking about NFPs. And that's why we're NFPs. And that's why we're here today.
NFT. I'm really lucky that I don't connect with that many people who are into that. Like I had one friend who's not even, he's not an artist or anything. He's like, have you thought about doing NFTs? I'm like, yeah, no. And then I had what's the nice way of putting this? A very interesting person come up to me when I was doing a dedication for my mural recently, who came up to me and was like, have you thought of making this into an NFT? And I feel like, have you thought about making this into an NFT is the new, have you thought about Jesus, or have you met Jesus?
So I know the answer to this is not NFTs. is there, so you were mentioning earlier that you recently wrote a collection. What are you working on right now?
A number of things. I just finished a comic for a children's magazine called Kazoo that'll be out next year. I've got a couple of other comics things in the mix. I'm not allowed to talk about a bunch of stuff, but I'm just going to say that I have two books that I've finished that are not in print yet. And I have one book that's coming out next month, which is it's a gag collection of sexy fruits and vegetables, getting it on. And it's called Dirty Produce. Uh-huh. And the New Yorker Daily Shouts did a feature about it. If you go to my Twitter, I have it as my pinned post. So you could see a little excerpt of that there,
Nice.
There's it's fun. It's silly. And I'm thinking, wow, I've done all these comics about feelings for so long. It's nice to do sexy fruits and maybe that'll be my legacy. That's fine.
It's part of a balanced diet, really.
Sure. You need your fiber. And then I have other things in the mix where I'm, trying to sell pitches and trying to make books and stuff. Lately, I've been in the brainstorming phase for a couple of books, and I just have to say that's such an exciting time because, that's when you're thinking, this could be it. This could be the one that lets me tell my husband he can quit his day job. But, obviously that's never going to happen. But that's the hope. If not the Dirty Produce, then, some young adult book or something. But it is very exciting coming up with these scenarios. And especially I'm writing fiction again, too, or playing with fiction where I'm just, dreaming up things and it's just wonderful letting your imagination go. And at my therapist appointment, not to bring up my therapist too much, but oh my God, I love therapy. I'm so excited. Why did I wait so long to get therapy? my therapist pointed out that, this feature of my brain that lets me just run free and think of all these new wonderful scenarios for these characters that don't exist, but kind of do, is the same mechanism in my brain that makes me catastrophize about like stupid things that aren't even going to happen. Like I see some horrible thing in the news about something that happened to a dog or something. And I'm like, oh no, what if that was my dog? And I'm like, thanks brain. That's really helpful. Like, where am I going to go with that? And she's like, you realize that those are both your imagination. And I'm like, oh yeah, that is the same thing. And she's like, you know, you could always like take that whatever, I can't pronounce it, but like you instead of thinking of horrible things that could happen, maybe you can train your brain to think of nice things that happen. And of course I had to joke and say, well, you know, sad stories sell. Like, no one wants to hear a happy story. Which is only a joke. Happy stories are good too. But I was kind of blown away, like, oh yeah, that is like the same brain is doing both of those things and letting itself be free with thoughts. And yeah, it's something that's definitely been on my mind lately as I brainstorm happy things.
It's so nice to think about like imagination and elasticity as the core of both creativity and anxiety. Cause so often it feels like those things are so opposite and so fighting against each other.
But absolutely. Cause anxiety makes me not be able to do anything like, you know, productive, but yeah, it is the same thing. It's just a matter of channeling, blowing my mind. Wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. I'm very excited to see what you draw with that in mind. Yeah.
Hopefully my comics won't get boring now that I have therapy. We'll see.
Oh, your happiness will sell. Your happiness will sell. Your hot fruit will sell.
You know, they this is the first work I think that has come directly from a happy place is the sexy fruit, because honestly, every single one that I think there's like almost 100 of them in the book, and every single page was just me like giggling the whole time. So hopefully that'll make people, the readers, giggle too. Who knows? It's fine if it's just me.
That's such a nice creative process to think about, just every page a new laugh. Cool. Well, it's been so nice to interview you.
Thank you.
Who joined partway through, this has been Mari Naomi talking to us about Dragon's Breath, her collection that came out a couple years ago. Thank you so much, Mari. It's been really great to have you.
Thank you. This was fun. Thanks for talking about my book.
Thank you. It was great.